welcome to the Progressive Radio News Hour. I'm Steve Lindman. Again, two guests, both Saturday and Sunday, and I want to begin both days with a segment from Tripoli, again, with Mahdi Nazemroya. Mahdi has been there for weeks doing heroic work on the ground, seeing firsthand what is happening and reporting back real information that he'll do today and again on Sunday in short segments, exactly the opposite of what the major media are reporting. They're just spewing one lie after another. Of course, that's their specialty. This program is the antidote to what they do. And, of course, Mahdi is, again, for listeners who didn't hear him in previous weeks, Mahdi is a Middle East and Central Asian analyst. He's also a research associate for the Center for Research on Globalization. Mahdi, I welcome you back, and it's an ongoing saga day by day by day. What's the latest you can report to listeners?
Well, this week has been a roller coaster ride here, psychologically speaking. The media war has been intensified. As you know, there's been claims that a lot of cities in western Libya have fallen to the insurgency or the so-called rebels, whatever you'd like to label them. These claims are false. Al Jazeera has made these claims. Sky News has made these claims. The mainstream corporate media has made these claims. It's part of the psychological war and the ongoing media war. They've said that Zawiya has fallen. They've said that Sorman, which was the scene of a very brutal massacre, had fallen. These statements are not true at all. It's actually quite the inverse. The city of Misurata, the port city of Misurata on the Mediterranean Sea, actually most of the major cities here on the Mediterranean Sea, the port city of Misurata has fallen to government forces. The Libyan armed forces have entered Misurata many days ago, and they cleared most of the city, and they did not position themselves in Misurata because NATO airstrikes, but they did clear the cities of the so-called rebels. And this was the actual big city that had fallen, but it was inverse. It was to the Libyan government. The government in Tripoli had regained Misurata, and it was not Zawiya or Sirman, not at all. So there's been a lot of hype. There's been this psychological war, and to be very honest with you, the psychological war did have some effects here in Tripoli and other parts of Libya. The Tripoli district was affected, and other parts of Libya were, because the forces that went into the forces that have gone into Zawiya, or south of Zawiya actually, within the district of Zawiya, which includes Zawiya and a couple of other urban centers. This caused somewhat of a mental hiccup or shock, and this is actually the biggest danger in Libya, because the Libyans are winning the war. The Libyans are winning the war. The biggest threat to their victory is the psychological threat. It's if they give in to fear and they give in to the media lies that are being propagated and disseminated at an astounding level around the world, not just here in North Africa, where satellites are trying to beam in information, and the BBC and France 24 and Al Jazeera are actively non-neutral and helping the transitional council based in Benghazi. They've actually helped set up programs and radio and TV stations there. So this is the biggest fear. If they give in, I mean, danger is if they give in to this fear. And some people have. There were a few defections as well, and there was a bit of fear in Tripoli. But that is now faded. That is now faded.
Mahdi, let me ask you this: is Libyan state TV still operating?
Yes, it is, but it is consistently attacked. I know the head of the Libyan Broadcasting Corporation here, Libyan Broadcasting Authority.
So its availability then to the Libyan people is touch and go. They can't turn on the TV set.
No, it's consistent. It's almost. Since I've been here, and I've been here about 2 months. It's been attacked, but programming is consistent. There's more than one channel. They also have French and English services, and it's been consistent. Radio and TV have been working, although their facilities have consistently been attacked by NATO, which claims to be silencing Gaddafi propaganda to protect civilians, you know. But this is very obvious. They want to silence Libya and Libya's voice to the world and to break up communications in Libya. But although it's been attacked and its journalists have been killed, and the NATO and the Obama administration have done everything they could to hurt it, it's still working fine.
What I'm really getting at is maybe Libyans can get Al Jazeera and BBC and anything that you can get online. There's so much, if they're even able to access online, because I guess the bombing is disrupting electricity and so on.
The internet's not available to most Libyans, but on television they could get satellite feeds from Al Jazeera and BBC, yes. Like, for example, my hotel. The hotels are a special case. There's a different type of equipment here. For example, I have Al Jazeera Arabic, I have Al Jazeera English, I have BBC, I have BBC English, I have German television in German, English, and Arabic. I have Italian, I have Press TV of Iran, I have some Persian programs, I have a multitude of Spanish programs here. So in the hotels, it's a different story of what the rest of the population has access to. They don't have access to the internet. Al Jazeera is blocked here.
What I'm really getting at, Marty, is if they can get Libyan television, they can go to any of the Libyan channels, Libyan state channels, and get information that is completely different than what they're getting from BBC, Al Jazeera, and the rest.
Yes, they definitely do, Steve. They have access to their own television and radios, and they're on the ground. So believe me, the BBC propaganda is not affecting them. It's affecting the outside. The British Broadcasting Corporation and CNN and Sky News and Fox are affecting the outside, and Libyans on the outside. The Libyans who live in Europe or Canada or Turkey or the United States, these Libyans are in fear, and they talk to their relatives here, and this is part of the effect. But the ones here know that BBC is openly lying. Most of them. But they do get Al Jazeera too, and some of them, it has sparked fears, but it's not a major force.
The Libyans have to understand, and everybody has to understand, that BBC is controlled, funded by the British government. Britain is one of the key NATO partners in this daily atrocity going on against the Libyan people. Qatar, as you have reported, not only is Qatar part of this coalition where Al Jazeera is based, but Qatari troops are on the ground working with the rebels.
Yes, there are reports that Qatari forces are here. I want to mention that U.S. forces are here as well. There are U.S. special forces on the ground. They've been spotted, even by journalists from the so-called Western world. They've seen them in the Western mountains. There's now some YouTube tapes, and if you want to believe those tapes or not, but that type of evidence is available. And as you know, the CIA has openly admitted they've been operating here with other U.S. forces. So they are all here. An Al Jazeera armored vehicle has also been it's been taped. Not Al Jazeera, Qatari armored vehicle from the Sheikdom of Qatar. It was in Benghazi. It helped put down the protests and the movement against the transitional council there. So yeah, they are here. I'd like to mention that a shipload of military hardware, including armored vehicles, was brought to Tunis by Qatar, all right, with the United States, the awareness of the United States government. So it was brought to Qatar, to the port of Zarzis, which is in Djerba, the island of Djerba, here near the border with the frontier with Libya. And several armored vehicles were seen on it. And you know who prevented these vehicles and the military supplies from being unloaded? It was the Tunisian people. The local Tunisian civilian population was mostly against it, and they this is from the reports I'm hearing, and they prevented the vehicles from being unloaded. And these vehicles, I want to say, are Retels. They're South African make. They're South African military hardware. So they come from the Republic of South Africa, which Qatar buys from them. Other countries like the Hashemite Kingdom of Jordan also buy these weapons from South Africa. So these vehicles were brought by them, these armored vehicles, and the Tunisian people prevented it, prevented them from being unloaded. So what happened is, from the reports I'm hearing, is the Tunisian military escorted these vehicles to the border. At the same time that NATO started attacking border posts and border cities, bombing them, Libyan border posts and Libyan cities on the border, at the same time as these attacks, the Tunisian military escorted these to the border to transfer to the rebels. So there's a coordination here of sending weapons from the West. So they want to open up. There is a Western front, but they want to open up a far broader Western front, from the reports I'm hearing, and those armored vehicles could have made their way to the rebels right now, because the rebels do control one road going to Tunis, and there's three supply routes. Well, I won't call them supply routes, but three roads that go towards Tunis. The most southernmost one is controlled by them, which is south of the Western Mountains. The northern one is controlled by the Libyan government. And now the one on the Mediterranean coast, which is in the area of Tripolitania, is where that's where Zawiya and Sirmaan are, between Tripoli and the Tunisian city of Djerba, and that's controlled by the Libyan government. But that's where there's been sparse fighting, and people like Ian Woods of Sky News have reported that the rebels have taken over. That area has not been taken over. That was very wishful thinking by Sky News and Al Jazeera, such as Zina Khodr, who reported it, who's been embedded with the rebels. You know, what the rebels did is they basically raised some flags near the district of Zawiya, and they quickly left because the local population didn't support them. There were also cells, insurgent cells, who prematurely rose up, took up guns, and this actually really ruined their operations. They didn't wait for the main force to arrive. And the main force, what I'm talking about, is not thousands of people. The main force is 100 to maximum 230 people. So this force came, drove northwards from the inland of Libya, from the Western Mountains, and they passed by Sirmaan, the city of Sirmaan, which again I'd like to emphasize was the scene of a massacre where children and animals were killed. They drove through Sirmaan, and this is where you get the stories that they took over Sirmaan, and they went to Zawiya. Now, what they try to do in Zawiya is there's oil infrastructure, energy infrastructure there. They've either tried to take it over, which they have not been successful in doing, or they try to damage it. This is part of the ongoing siege that NATO has envisaged against the local population, the civilian population of Tripoli. This is part of the humanitarian disaster that the Obama administration and the government of of Prime Minister Cameron and the criminal cabinet of Nicolas Sarkozy want to impose on the Libyan people.
Marty, I want to wrap it up for today, and we're going to pick up on this again tomorrow, but there's no question that what is going on in Libya, this is a Washington-led, I say it all the time, any war that Washington gets involved in, Washington is the boss, it leads it, and reports in the U.S. are that the Pentagon is sending more drones to Libya. Well, you know what those drones will have. They'll have bombs, missiles, whatever they have. So they'll be actively participating in more bombing. You said all the time, we can talk more tomorrow, that the bombing continues intensively. Civilians are being targeted, civilian infrastructure, things unrelated to military activities. And the idea is to inflict severe punishment on the Libyan people to get them to want to just do anything to end this and surrender, just to end the daily punishment. But if they surrender, it'll just be worse. What do you want? Would you rather die instead of being enslaved if NATO gets a stranglehold on your country, what the Iraqis are going through, what the Afghans are going through, what any country goes through when America and its allies show up? All they want to do is plunder a country and exploit the people. Anybody who gets in their way, they just get rid of them. They kill them. So it's a daily atrocity going on in Libya. I don't think there is too much on U.S. television about this, Marty. I think it's kind of dropped off. But if there are any reports, it's the same kind of rubbish about the so-called rebels advancing and Gaddafi losing, and it's just a matter of time. And I've heard one or two reports that by the end of Ramadan, the rebels think they're going to be victorious. Well, if they didn't have an air force, the rebels would have been routed months ago. But let's end it there, and we'll pick it up again tomorrow, Marty. Again, my great thanks to you for what you're doing and coming on this program and informing my listeners. Thanks, Marty.
My pleasure.
Well, Marty, indeed, we'll be back tomorrow with another segment on what's happening in Libya, which is absolutely opposite of what you get in the major media, whether in the U.S., the European media. There are some honest sources, Press TV. Iran's Press TV will present some honest sources. They're kind of going both ways a little bit on the Libya story, but I personally know one of their correspondents, and she is in Libya, and she puts out marvelous reports. She's been on this program, and she's coming back again to do more. It's an important story, and it's important to keep repeating it. But I want to get to my guest, John Cozy. John is well known to listeners. He's a retired philosophy professor. He's now writing on social, political, and economic issues. He taught for many years. He's been writing for many more. He writes marvelous articles. They're on many websites, including his own one. It's www.jcozy.com. John, if you'd allow me one comment before we jump in.
Sure, go ahead, Steve.
I relish summers in Chicago, especially downtown. It's the best time of year, it really is, and the weather is glorious, nice and warm most days. It's kind of chilly today. Most days it's nice and warm, humidity generally low, and just a joy to be around Chicago downtown, except for one weekend, this weekend. This weekend is the annual Air and Water Show. Now, doesn't that sound benign? It's anything but benign. Less the water part of it than the air part of it. The air part of it is literally a bald-faced commercial for militarism. You get the Navy Blue Angels, the Army equivalent of them, and they do stunt flying. And the idea is to get young people all excited to want to fly one of these airplanes. Well, what does flying one of these airplanes mean? It doesn't mean doing stunts over Chicago. It means going to Iraq, going to Afghanistan, going to Libya, going to Somalia, going to all of these places, bombing, killing, and destroying. That's what it means. So the Air and Water Show every year in Chicago and other cities around the country are bald-faced stunts to arouse young people to want to become killers. I hate this weekend, John. I must add that it is very, very overcast in Chicago today. Yesterday was a nice day. Today it is extremely overcast, low ceiling. Maybe it's just low enough and bad enough to wipe these guys out. I just can't imagine anybody wanting to fly, especially too low, especially doing stunts on a day like today. But you never know what these people have in mind. I will know. I don't have to look out the window. I'm downtown where they fly. All I have to do is listen. You can hear the roar of the jet engines. They're flying that low. And I will know if they're flying. It's a little bit early in the day. Usually later in the afternoon they begin. And they'll probably delay as long as possible today, John, to see if that ceiling will lift to give them a little bit of flying weather. I hope it falls instead of lifts. Anyway, that's my 2 cents worth. We want to talk about shamans.
Shamans.
Oh, John, I remember. I grew up in Boston. I remember a shaman in Boston. His name was Bill. He was a different kind of shaman. I like that shaman, but the kind of shamans you wrote about, I'll let you describe them.
Well, there's a prominent economist named Danny Roderick. Recently wrote a book, and in it he had an afterword that he decided to put online. He titled that afterword proverb. I read it and I thought, what a stupid little piece this is. And then I found out that he had added another article online explaining the proverb, which struck me as strange to begin with. Well, anyhow, his proverb isn't a proverb. It's an allegory, and it doesn't make any sense at all. And when I worked out the contradictions in it, it seemed obvious that from what he said, you could prove that all war was the result of international trade. So I wrote this little piece, and put it out there.
Well, I'll let you explain that further. I mean, your allegory, parable, I guess you can call it whatever you want. Oh, it was a little bit different sort of article that you write, John, but the point that you made was right on the mark.
Yeah, you see, what he did, he suggested in this parable, allegory, whatever it is. Nonsense is really what it is. He told a story about a little fishing village in some remote part of the world that was separated from all nearby villages by distance and the dense forest. The inhabitants of whom were making their living fishing the lake that the village was on. And making clothing, but he never stated, you know, how the people were making clothing or what they were making it out of. And it always struck me as strange that they could be making clothing and not gaining some way of sustaining themselves by doing so. But nevertheless, you know, he did that. And then he went, the villagers went to the shaman and, asked for help, and he made a suggestion, which was, well, reduce the fishing. And that worked, and they went back to him and thanked him, and he then said, well, since you all seemed interested in, you know, my suggestions, let me offer some more. And he ended up offering a suggestion that they trade with other villages, and to do so they had to build a road and do all sorts of stuff. And every time they did this, of course, things got worse. And we ended up, you know, with various villages trading with each other, and the little village that from which all this started on the lake was being reduced economically more and more and more and more by all of this trade, which was supposed to bring them all this prosperity. And he stopped there. And I thought to myself, well, that's a typical economist. He never goes any further. Never goes further, because one of the things that's obvious from the piece is that the economic proposals that this shaman was making were just policy proposals. They weren't result of any economic theory or natural law or anything else. And they could have been changed just easily by another shaman, or even himself, if he changed his mind, and that is the character of economics in the Western world. People think it's some kind of science. It is not. It is just a bunch of policy proposals made by people who think they know how to make things better, but almost always make them worse. That was the one point I made. The other point I made was, what happens at these villages that are involved in all this trade when one of them once more of what some other village has than the other village is willing to give. And the obvious answer is, the shaman is, well, you create an army and you take it. And that, you know, is what has happened in the world, not only throughout history, but especially during the 20th and now in the 21st century. So that the conclusion that you have to draw from Roderick's little allegory is that international conflict, all war, as a matter of fact, are wars of plunder brought upon by economic policies. And that was the point that I was trying to make with the piece, that I think I made it. I made it at the end and where it should have been. But I don't think I hinted that it was coming until the end. But, yeah, that's the way it went.
And I love the way you ended it with your final comment, where basically you're saying, I mean, one bad policy leads to another bad policy until you create just an intolerable situation, and then you end it with a Henny Youngman joke.
Yeah.
If listeners remember the old-time comedian Henny Youngman, I sure remember him.
Oh, I remember him. He was great.
Oh, he was great. A lot of one-liners,
yeah.
Or close to one-liners. And you ended saying he went to his doctor and said, when I do this, it hurts, Doc. And the doc said, well, stop doing it.
Yeah.
Well, the same applies to shamans or shamans. You know, I mean, if what they're doing hurts, well, stop.
Yeah, and that's something they don't seem to understand. They always want to fix instead of stop. And, of course, what they fix is the result of what they fix is worse. So, you know, that's what happens.
Oh, it sure is. So you get one trade treaty that just is catastrophic for people in all negotiating countries. So you have a NAFTA involving three countries. The working people in all three countries suffer as a result of it. The shamans, I guess, make out, John, so they keep doing stuff like this.
Yeah.
Or the people they represent, they make out, and the people they represent make out. But the working people all suffer in these countries. And then you do it in three countries, and then you do it globally with a WTO, and everybody suffers.
Yep. And what's interesting to me is that Roderick's original book is something rather like about the failure of globalization or something like that, it's titled. And there are a number of economists recently are beginning to speak up about how globalization has failed. And I shake my head when I hear this and see this, and I say, Dan, go back to my website and read some of the articles that were written back there 5 and 6 years ago about how globalization was bound to fail, could not possibly succeed, you know. But they don't read anything. You there?
Yeah. Oh, I thought we got cut off for a minute, John. No, go.
Yeah, so did
continue.
I. But that's what, you know, that's what happens. All these economists are good for is armchair comments. That's about what it amounts to.
Oh, indeed. So, of course, these people have their own agenda, John, and they pretend that they're doing things that will benefit everybody, you know, lift all boats. But they don't lift all boats. They lift all yachts, not the other boats.
Yeah, the interesting thing, you know, it's hard. The economists themselves love to get into other people's minds. They're always saying that, you know, if the economy does this, people are going to do that, and that sort of thing. Well, that, you know, there were economists who said that the reason that people got into such a debt was that they felt wealthier because their houses were more valuable or something. I said, you know, that's sure nonsense. I mean, I know a lot of people whose houses went up in value who didn't feel any wealthier. What got them into debt was bankers sending them all these easy-to-acquire credit cards with all these amounts of money that they could go out and spend, and not, you know, making clear how deadly collecting the interest is going to be on them. But that's what led them into debt, not the housing price increase. But economists don't know that. I mean, they have this, you know, gee whiz, we have this law. You know, this happens, and then people do so-and-so. Well, they don't. You know, I mean, I don't know where they think they can get into people's heads and do this. So I don't like to myself get into people's heads. I don't know why economists do what they do. Some of them may even believe it. I'm sure some of them don't. Some of them know it's baloney. And there are a lot who don't know one way or other. They just went out and got degrees and learned to do a certain thing, and they just do it thoughtlessly without thinking about it very much and forget about it.
John, I think there are a great many like that, and I think part of the motivation is if everybody else is saying something and you don't necessarily believe it, but if you say something differently than what they say, you will look like an outlier. I mean, you might even be ostracized. So you dare not not go along with consensus. So you see people. I don't watch very much in the way of television, John. A couple of times during the recent market turmoil, I turned on business channels just for a little bit to get a sense of what they were doing, where they were going, and what clearly is extreme turmoil, signaling what honest economists would say. And I've read some, and I've quoted some, that indeed a cold shower reality has finally dawned. It usually comes late, but it looks like it's finally arrived, and clearly markets are saying things are not well. I wrote an article I called No Joy in Mudville. The market struck out. That's my point, the Casey at the bat analogy. The economy is terrible for ordinary people. Only corporate profits have benefited over the last few years because people were left out. The majority of stimulus went to helping the big corporations, mainly the banks. Trillions of dollars handed to the banks, not used to benefit the economy, not used to stimulate growth, not used to create jobs. And now the stimulus for ordinary people has been cut off, replaced by austerity, and the economy is starting to weaken, John, noticeably in some of the recent numbers, even though they're manipulated to look better than in fact they really are. But you still see the so-called analysts and mainstream economists showing up on television. That the brief snapshot I got from a few of the comments I picked up, they're still in denial. Oh, a wonderful buying opportunity after this market sell-off. Well, this market sell-off may turn out to just be an appetizer. Who knows?
Financial analysts or commentators, you know, my wife watches one of them regularly. What's her name? A woman. Very popular.
Ooh. With her own program?
Yeah.
Oh, I'm not sure. I'm honestly not sure.
What the heck's her name? I don't pay attention. But anyhow, sometimes, I mean, she gives advice that's very, very popular, and it's most of it is commonsensical that any idiot would know, you know, what to do. But she also has in the back of her mind, all of these platitudes that you hear, you know, when prices are down, you buy, when prices are high, you sell, and all that kind of thing. And she's into that. Yeah, you know, now's the time to buy. I mean, look, not, you know, don't get out of the market. When anyone with any brains would say, this market is crazy. If you have any money in it that's worth anything right now, you better take it out and put it under your mattress, is what you ought to be telling people. I pointed out, I don't know when, years ago, that the stock market was nothing but a casino, that nobody invests knowing anything. They invest hoping, like the blackjack player in the casino. You know, he's taking a chance on a big win. And of course, there are, for most people in the market, there are no big wins. There never have been. The people who clean up in the market are the program traders, the people who put in huge amounts of money and make huge bets. And even if all of them don't pay off, if one or two of them do, they make huge amounts of money. And everybody else, their money just gets lost.
Well, that's exactly right, John. And during a bull market, as we had in the 80s and 1990s, ordinary people could get a fairly decent return on their investment if they just played it safe and didn't gamble. And in my new book coming out very shortly now, beginning of September, called How Wall Street Fleeces America, Privatized Banking, Government Collusion, and Class War, I have a chapter in it on how all markets are manipulated. It became institutionalized under Ronald Reagan, the so-called plunge protection committee. Several of them, as a matter of fact, but there was a Reagan executive order that literally institutionalized manipulation in the markets. The reason, the ostensible reason, the plunge protection team is what it's called, but there are several other devices along with the team. The ostensible reason, John, was in times when things are extremely disruptive, like the 1988 crash. 88? Yeah, I think it was an 88 crash. 20% in one day. That's a huge crash. In 1929, the crash of October 1929, there was no single day when the market dropped 20%. There were several. There was a Black Thursday, and there were several horror days that were replicated in October 2008, where there were massive falls. And if you added them all up over several days or a week in October 2008, I haven't added up the percentage, but it probably came to 20% or more. It was big. It was real big. And it was the closest thing to the equivalent of the 29 crash. But the idea behind the plunge protection team was, in times of these market emergencies, the government will go into the market and manipulate. Well, they'll let private bankers go into the market and manipulate it, supposedly to stabilize the markets. Well, you know, I mean, private bankers manipulate the markets to do anything they damn please to take them up, to take them down. And it's not just the stock market. It's all markets, commodities, bonds, anything that's tradable on any market is manipulated. And that's the way the game works. A few honest people have analyzed it in detail enough to give many examples and just lay out the case in black and white. There's no disputing this. But then you discover that there are actual government policies to manipulate the markets. Well, what does an individual investor who simply wants to make a few bucks, what does he or she know? Nothing.
Yeah, right, nothing. And that's true of I think, most of fund managers. I mean, that's the real trap for people. I mean, you got these fund managers who take people's money and stick it all over the place and then extract a good percentage of it as their fee and lose money.
That's right. And they take a very healthy fee for losing your money, John.
Yeah, you're right. Yeah, you know. So it's just one of those crazy things that people, you know, people don't listen to what's being said. You know, no financial advisor or financial advising company that tries to get people to invest ever tells you how well or poorly its clients have done. Never. They tell you all sorts of things about so-and-so can be trusted or, you know, all this. We've been in business so many years and everybody loves us, and I doubt that very much. But, you know, they tell those kind of lies.
Well, you know,
but
also,
they never tell you how their clients have done.
Well, what they do, John, is they will extract a period in time, a period when they did well, leaving out the period before or after or whatever,
when they didn't
do so well, to promote the average return of the fund over the years, such and such, to so-and-so.
Yeah, right. But now, if you added the
previous year or added one more year beyond where they go, the number might change drastically.
Yeah, and even so, when they calculate that number, that's only true for people who were in the fund the day that period started and held their money in the fund till the period ended.
Oh, exactly. But it's amazing what they can get people to believe. You repeat this stuff over and over again. The old story about the big lie, the bigger the lie, the more often it's repeated, the more likely more people are likely to believe it, and it works every time, no matter how often these people in the past were fooled.
Yeah. You know, there's a guy advertising automobiles and on television in this area right now, and he says, if I can't beat a competitor's price, I'll give you the car. You know, and people, wow. You know, and I say to myself, now, how damn dumb is that? He can always beat the price instead of giving you the car. You know, but people are influenced like that. There's a company selling internet service around here saying we've got the fastest internet for the price, and I say to myself, yeah, you probably are the only company in the area with that price, and no matter what speed you have, it's the fastest for that price. People just don't pay attention to what they're told.
They sure don't pay attention, or they pay attention to the wrong things. They misinterpret what they're told. They rely on the wrong sources. Some people, I can't imagine why anybody believes they can turn on their television set and get real news unless they happen to have, they certainly don't have Press TV on their television dial. Some cities have Russia Today that has very legitimate news. And, I mean, they have me come on. To speak as candidly, John, as I do on this program, on all kinds of topics. I've been on a number of times, and the same on Iran's Press TV. They have a marvelous service. Neither one is perfect. But you compare what they do to U.S. television, it is night and day, absolutely night and day. And they both invite me on, John, frequently to speak my mind freely. I have to stop and think how many different topics I have discussed. The last time I was on Press TV, it was on either the last time or the time before. I think it was the last time. It was on the riots in Britain.
Oh,
that have
yeah.
Nothing to do with
yeah.
the Middle
you mean,
East.
You mean those riots that were created by that large body of hooligans?
Called the British Parliament.
Yeah.
Oh, I absolutely believe that those riots were a false flag. Or you could give it any name you want, but the reasons just jump right out at you. And I must add, John, that I wrote an article today. I just felt I had to do it. I mentioned it in an article I put out this morning because I'd gotten the news and I wrote about another topic. I added a final section to mention what went on. The attacks inside Israel, where 7 or 8 Israelis were killed, attacks on 2 buses, 2 or 3 other attacks.
Yeah,
I think 7 Israelis were killed, a number injured. Israel followed with bombing Gaza multiple times. This is still going on today.
I mean, the attacks, supposedly were carried out by Egyptians. So Israel bombed Gaza.
Well, Israel blamed it on a coalition of Palestinian resistance groups. But coming in through the Sinai, now if they're Palestinians, how are they coming through the Sinai? But the story is completely preposterous, John.
Yeah, I know.
It absolutely reeks of a false flag. I mean, this just literally jumped out at me and said, if I ever spotted a potential false flag right at the time it happened, this one is absolutely glaring for compelling reasons. And I said, I have to write about them. And I did, and the article is done. It'll be on my blog tomorrow, Steve Lenman blog. It'll get a number of postings on websites, and the title is very simple. Another Israeli false flag question mark. Well, over the decades, Israel has committed numerous false flags. This is only the latest one. Why? Because there's a vote in the General Assembly next month about Palestinian statehood.
That's right.
They want to intimidate nations to think maybe this is not the best time to be granting Palestinian sovereignty, full UN membership, with Israel under attack. Maybe wait a while and think about it another time. Another major issue, John, weeks of social justice protests across Israel. Well,
yeah,
Israel can't bomb its own people. It can persecute them. It can arrest some, but you can't bomb Israelis like you do Palestinians. So how do you defuse this thing? Well, they already did it this weekend. There was another mass rally planned across Israel. It was canceled because of these attacks. Now, if they defuse this thing and the energy wanes, it can be very hard picking it back up again. Two compelling reasons, and there's another one. I think Israel wants another war against Gaza.
Right.
Well, we don't know, but it may have already begun.
Yeah, sure, right.
So Israel had every reason to pull off this attack. False flag, that's what it means. The Palestinians had every reason not to do it. Everything to lose, nothing to gain, case closed. Israel had everything to gain, nothing to lose. If that isn't prima facie evidence, I don't know what is. I don't have the smoking gun, John,
no.
But I'm pretty damn close.
Yeah, you hear all these stories and you say to yourself, you know, that can't possibly be true. But too many people just believe them. I mean, I don't know, you know, how to change that, here's the one that gets me. You know, I don't have anything bad to say about the Navy SEALs. I'm sure they work very hard. I'm sure they're, having been in some situations that are somewhat like theirs, you know, I understand what's going on there, that things never work out like you think they're going to and all of that kind of stuff. But the so-called Bin Laden raid was a disaster, and nobody says it. I mean, they flew in there. They lost a helicopter. They were supposed to land inside the compound. They had to blow in the wall to get in. If that compound had been defended by a dozen people, those Navy SEALs would have been wiped out.
Well, John, I agree.
That was a disaster.
Nobody
is saying a word about it. All of these people are saying what a glorious event this was, heroic event this was. And I say to myself, you're crazy. You know, it was a disaster. You lost the damn helicopter. Okay? And the Chinese have denied having had access to us, but I'll bet they have. I'll bet the Chinese know everything about that helicopter that was lost. We didn't even blow it up properly. So it was like the Carter raid into Iran where they lost helicopters.
Well,
the same sort of thing.
Oh, indeed, John. You know, on top of that, it was a staged event.
It was staged, and they couldn't pull it off.
Well, they couldn't pull it off, and it was proved long ago that Bin Laden died in December 2001. Among the people who confirmed it, the former president of Pakistan on British television, Benazir Bhutto, said that he died. I forget her precise words or how she explained it. But she was on the David Frost program, and she spilled the beans that Bin Laden had died many years ago, and I think that was one of the reasons that she was assassinated. But the cat was out of the bag. Also, the head of Pakistani intelligence, I believe he came on CNN and pretty much said the same thing and embarrassed the devil out of whoever was interviewing him. I think his name was Gould.
And he came on as the former head of Pakistani intelligence, their ISI, Inter-Intelligence Services Operation. But bin Laden was a very sick man, multiple illnesses, and he died in either a Rawalpindi hospital or a hospital in one of the Arab cities. And I mentioned this in a couple of articles. And the day before in the summer, I believe it was was it the day before 9/11 or the summer, there was a Dan Rather report on CBS that bin Laden was ill on dialysis in, I believe it was at Rawalpindi Hospital then, and he reported it. But the day before 9/11, he was either in that hospital or another one, and that was reported. I mean, he had nothing to do with 9/11, and even the videos that were released about him, supposedly that they portrayed him, several were exposed, not only as fakes, but very poor fakes. And I saw one of them, and the person they portrayed as bin Laden literally did not look anything like him. I don't know where they found this stand-in, but they couldn't even get a stand-in who looked reasonably like bin Laden.
Yeah.
This guy looked absolutely nothing like him, and they claimed it was bin Laden. I don't know the date that it came out, long before the stunt that was pulled off earlier.
Yeah, well, I'm just mentioning stories that I hear that if you listen to what's being said carefully, you say to yourself, that can't possibly be right. You know, I mean, the kind of thing, I'll give you another one. I don't like to talk about Israel or the Holocaust or that period of time because horrible things took place in Europe during that war and Jews and Gypsies and Ukrainians and Bulgarians and all sorts of people suffered horrific deaths, that war, and, you know, it's just one of these terrible things. But the claim is, you know, that the Germans had a final solution, and they moved all these people, they picked up all these people in all sorts of places in Europe and run them by railroad to camps where they built all these ovens and stuff. And I say to myself, what? I say to myself, what if I wanted to eliminate all the dogs in the state? Would I send people out to capture them all, corral them, put them in rail cars, ship them miles and miles and miles to an and build an extermination camp to exterminate the dogs? I mean, does that make sense? Or would I just kill them when I saw them? You know, I mean, ask yourself, what would you do? Why would you waste all the money and the time and the military equipment and all of that shipping people around the world to exterminate them when all you have to do is shoot them? It doesn't make any sense.
Well, you're making absolute sense, John, and it diverts money and resources and time from the war effort. And of course, we obviously despise what Hitler did, war-wise and every other way. But it seemed like a foolish decision to divert resources that were needed to wage his wars. And he spent so much time at railroads and all the camps shipping people off to be, people who were not a threat to the Third Reich. So, you know, I mean, your priority should be to worry about the threats and then worry about everything else.
I'm not trying to denigrate the horrors that Jews in Europe suffered during that war. I mean, they were really horrific. But, you know, the story doesn't make any sense. I mean, and that's the only part of it I'm trying to make. I mean, if you're going to put out a story, at least put out a story that makes some sense, has some logic to it, not a bunch of claims that are idiotic.
Well, John, I agree with you. And the policies we have in our own country so often are just as nonsensical, counterproductive, destructive, and you have to wonder, who are the people who dream up these things, and what motive do they have for doing this? Why on earth are they doing the wrong thing when so often the right thing is not that tough to know, so why don't they do it?
And easier to do.
And easier to do, exactly.
Yeah, and that brings me back to my piece. And my piece, I guess, can be summed up as a comment on an idiotic story told by a prominent economist. You know, so it's just another one of these stories that don't make any damn sense. And anybody with any brains who reads it should know that, should see it. So I guess that brings us full circle.
Oh, it really does, John. And I try to emphasize in my book that any policies, economic policies, that aren't directed toward productive economic growth are policies doomed to fail. And everything this country has done under George Bush, once the economic crisis broke, and under Obama, have been the opposite of stimulating productive economic growth. You don't do it by bailing out bankers. You don't do it with other corporate handouts. You do it by directing resources, simply put. All kinds of things can generate productive growth. And it's not rocket science. It's simple economics. And the economists in both administrations, I mean, I can't imagine they don't know these things, but certainly the policies that they pursued had nothing to do with stimulating economic growth. Boosting corporate profits? You betcha.
You betcha.
Not stimulating economic growth. So the yachts got lifted, and the dinghies were sunk.
Yeah, you know, when the Bush administration at its end proposed the banker bailout that the Obama administration then implemented.
Oh, yeah, Joe, we are out of time. 10 seconds.
I just wanted to say, I said, this is idiotic. You're giving the money to the wrong people. And that's exactly what they did.
Oh, exactly. And here we are in a mess, and I expect the second wave of the mess to end up being a lot worse than the first wave.
Yeah,
John, I look
I
forward
too.
To next time.
I do, too.
Thank you, John. And join us again tomorrow.